Welcome back to Claw Talks. I'm Emma, and today we're covering something that has been unfolding in real time this week, the Iran war. Because yes, at this point we're calling it that.
I'm Ryan. And look, this is genuinely one of the most significant geopolitical events since the invasion of Ukraine in 2022. We're talking about Iran's supreme leader being killed, missiles hitting Dubai, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the entire Gulf on fire in a way that nobody in that region wanted.
So let's start with the question everyone is asking right now. Why did Iran bomb Dubai? Because Dubai, for most people, is this gleaming city of skyscrapers and brunches and business. It doesn't seem like an obvious target in a war between Iran and Israel.
Right. And the answer is layered. It's part military logic, part symbolism, and part a very deliberate regional strategy by Iran. But to properly understand it, we have to rewind, not just to last week, but all the way back through decades of history. Because this didn't come out of nowhere.
Let's do it. Walk me through the Iran-Israel relationship, because I think people know there's a conflict but might not know how deep it goes.
Okay, so here's something that genuinely surprises people. Iran and Israel were not always enemies. In fact, before 1979, they were effectively allies. Both were US-aligned states in the Middle East. Iran under the Shah Ali Mohammad Reza Pahlavi had diplomatic relations with Israel, traded with Israel, and actually received Israeli military and intelligence cooperation.
Which is wild to hear given what we're watching today.
It's a completely different world. But then comes 1979, and everything changes. The Islamic Revolution. Ayatollah Khomeini leads a mass uprising, the Shah is deposed, and Iran transforms virtually overnight from a secular pro-Western monarchy into an Islamic theocratic republic.
And Israel immediately becomes the enemy.
Immediately. Khomeini was a hardline anti-Zionist. He called Israel an illegitimate state, an occupier of Palestinian land. Within weeks of the revolution, Iran's Israeli embassy was handed over to the Palestine Liberation Organization. The phrase that would become a defining slogan of the Islamic Republic, "Death to Israel," enters the political lexicon.
So it was ideological from the start, not a territorial dispute between the two countries.
Exactly. Iran and Israel don't share a border. They don't have a direct territorial grievance. The conflict is rooted in ideology. Iran's brand of revolutionary Islamism frames the existence of Israel as an injustice to the Muslim world, particularly to the Palestinian people. And from that ideology flows a decades-long strategy.
The proxy war strategy.
Right. Iran's approach has been, we will fight Israel, but not directly, not yet. We will build a network of allied militant groups across the region to fight on our behalf and keep Israel perpetually under threat. The Iranians call this the Caxis of Resistance.
What groups are we talking about?
The most significant is Hezbollah, the Lebanese Shia militant group that Iran literally helped create in 1982, after Israel's invasion of Lebanon. Iran's Revolutionary Guards went in, trained Hezbollah fighters, funded the organization. To this day, Hezbollah is effectively an extension of Iranian power sitting right on Israel's northern border.
And it fought a full war with Israel.
2006, yes. A 34-day conflict that killed more than 1,000 people. Hezbollah fired thousands of rockets into northern Israel. That conflict ended in a kind of bloody stalemate that both sides claimed as a victory. But Hezbollah survived and actually grew stronger.
What else is in this axis of resistance?
Hamas in Gaza. Iran has funded and armed Hamas for decades. Palestinian Islamic Jihad, also in Gaza. The Houthis in Yemen, they've been firing drones and missiles at Saudi Arabia and ships in the Red Sea for years. And then various Shia militias in Iraq and Syria. Iran effectively has a network of armed proxies from the Mediterranean coast all the way through Iraq to the Persian Gulf.
It's a kind of deterrence ring around Israel and around American interests in the region.
Exactly. And the strategy worked, in a perverse way. For decades, Iran avoided direct military confrontation with Israel or the United States while constantly bleeding both of them through proxy warfare. That's a sustainable strategy if you can keep it going.
So what broke it? What shifted from this low-grade proxy war to actual direct confrontation?
October 7, 2023. Hamas's mass terror attack on southern Israel, 1,200 people killed, 250 taken hostage. It was the worst day for Jewish people since the Holocaust. And Israel's response was categorical, a ground invasion of Gaza, a campaign to destroy Hamas.
And that pulled the whole axis of resistance in.
Exactly. Hezbollah started firing from Lebanon. The Houthis started attacking shipping in the Red Sea and firing ballistic missiles toward Israel. Iranian-backed militias attacked U.S. bases in Iraq. It was like the whole network got activated. And throughout all of this, Iran was still playing its traditional game, providing weapons, intelligence, funding, but not directly attacking Israel.
Until April 2024.
Yes. That's the moment everything shifts. Israel had killed several senior Iranian officers in a strike on Iran's consulate in Damascus, Syria. And Iran decided it had to respond directly. For the first time in history, Iran launched a direct attack on Israeli territory, over 300 drones and ballistic missiles fired toward Israel.
Which Israel and its allies mostly intercepted.
Largely intercepted, yes, Israel, the US, UK, France, and Jordan all worked together to shoot them down. The actual damage on the ground was minimal. But the psychological barrier had been broken. Iran had crossed the line from proxy war to direct attack. And then Israel hit back. Strikes inside Iran. Iran fired again in October 2024. By this point, you have two nuclear threshold countries trading blows directly for the first time.
And then June 2025.
June 2025 is the real pivot point. The US and Israel launched what was described at the time as a 12-day campaign against Iran, specifically targeting its nuclear program. Three Iranian nuclear facilities were bombed. Israel called it existential self-defense. Iran's nuclear ambitions had been a red line for Israel for 20 years. Here's the thing, Iran was getting very close to weapons-grade uranium enrichment. The intelligence assessments were frightening.
And that brings us to February 28, 2026.
Right. There had been nuclear negotiations throughout late 2025, the US trying to broker some kind of deal, Iran refusing to give ground. Those talks collapsed. And then on February 28, the US and Israel launched Operation Epic Fury, the US name, and Operation Lion's Roar, Israel's name for its component.
2,000 targets.
Roughly 2,000 targets across Iran. Military infrastructure, air defense systems, ballistic missile stockpiles, nuclear sites. And, in the most consequential single moment of the operation, Supreme Leader Ali Khamenei was killed.
That's still almost unreal to say out loud.
It is. Khamenei had led Iran since 1989, 36 years as Supreme Leader. He was 86 years old. He was the single most powerful figure in the Iranian system. His death creates an enormous political vacuum in Tehran at exactly the moment when Iran is trying to mount a military response.
So then the retaliation comes.
Within hours, Iran fires 189 ballistic missiles, over 900 drones, cruise missiles, not just at Israel, but at every US military base in the region. And this is where Dubai comes in.
So let's go back to the original question. Why Dubai? Why the UAE?
Okay, so there are several layers. The first is pure military logic. The UAE hosts one of the largest American Air Force installations in the world outside the United States. Al Dhafra Air Base near Abu Dhabi. Thousands of US troops, advanced fighter jets, surveillance aircraft. It's a staging post for US operations across the entire region. If you're Iran and you want to hit American power projection in the Middle East, Al Dhafra is on your list.
And was Al Dhafra hit?
It was targeted. Most missiles and drones were intercepted, but there was damage from secondary explosions, and falling debris from intercepts hit civilian areas nearby. One Pakistani civilian was killed near the airport. The UAE's air defenses, along with US, French, Australian, and British assets, intercepted the vast majority. Out of 174 ballistic missiles tracked, 161 were intercepted. Out of nearly 700 drones, 645 were shot down.
So the air defense is mostly held, but Dubai still got hit.
Because even when you intercept missiles at altitude, the debris has to fall somewhere. And Dubai International Airport, one of the world's busiest airports, was struck in Terminal 3. Staff injuries, an evacuation, flight chaos worldwide. The Burj Al Arab got damage from intercept debris. A drone hit near the Fairmont on Palm Jumeirah. A fire broke out at Jebel Ali Port.
Which is exactly Iran's secondary message. You can say you intercepted everything, but Dubai isn't safe.
Precisely. And that's the strategic genius of Iran's approach, if we can call it that. Iran is targeting the Gulf's most valuable asset, its reputation as a stable, safe hub for business, tourism, and finance. Dubai's entire economy is built on being the place where East and West intersect, where you can fly anywhere, park your money, do deals, stay in luxury hotels. If that image is shattered, the economic damage is enormous.
Let's talk about the broader Iran-UAE tension, because there's more to it than just the American military bases, isn't there?
There really is. The Iran-UAE relationship has its own very old wounds, completely separate from the Israel conflict. And the most important one is the Three Islands dispute.
Tell me about that.
So in the Strait of Hormuz, the narrow passage through which roughly 20% of the world's oil flows, there are three small but strategically critical islands. Abu Musa, Greater Tunb, and Lesser Tunb. In 1971, Iran under the Shah moved to occupy all three islands. The timing was extraordinary, just 2 days before the UAE officially came into existence as an independent nation.
2 days. So before the UAE even existed as a country, its islands had been taken.
Exactly. The UAE considers this an illegal occupation and has demanded the return of the islands at every possible diplomatic forum for over 50 years. Iran refuses. The islands give whoever controls them the ability to monitor and potentially threaten shipping through the Strait of Hormuz. They're militarily significant. And they're a constant source of grievance.
So the UAE and Iran have been in this unresolved territorial dispute since the UAE was literally founded.
Right. And on top of that, the UAE signed the Abraham Accords in 2020, normalizing diplomatic relations with Israel. That was a major deal, brokered by the Trump administration. For Iran, this was a betrayal of the first order. The UAE was an Arab, Muslim-majority country that had just made peace with the Zionist state. From Iran's perspective, the UAE chose sides.
And then Bahrain followed suit with the Abraham Accords too.
Yes. Both Bahrain and the UAE. Saudi Arabia was inching toward normalization as well. This whole trajectory, Arab Gulf states warming to Israel while hosting American bases, was existentially threatening to Iran's regional strategy.
What had the UAE's relationship with Iran been like more recently, though? I thought they were trying to de-escalate.
They were. And this is the tragedy of the situation for the Gulf states. After years of hostility, both the UAE and Saudi Arabia had actually been working to rebuild bridges with Iran. Saudi Arabia and Iran restored diplomatic relations in March 2023, brokered by China, a major diplomatic moment. The UAE was engaging Iran commercially and diplomatically. Gulf states, as one expert put it, realized they had to live with Iran as a neighbor and that regional stability required incorporating Iran in some way.
And then they got dragged into a war they've been trying to avoid.
Dragged in is exactly right. No Gulf state coordinated with the US and Israel in the initial Operation Epic Fury strikes. They weren't consulted. They woke up on February 28th to a regional war whether they wanted it or not. And then Iranian missiles started landing on their soil.
Let's map out all the countries involved because it's a lot.
It really is. At the center, you have the three direct military belligerents, the United States, Israel, and Iran. All firing weapons at each other.
Then there's the Gulf states.
The UAE, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, and Oman all received Iranian missiles or drones. All of them host U.S. military bases. Qatar hosts Al Udeid Air Base, that's the headquarters of U.S. Central Command, CENTCOM, with 10,000 American troops. Bahrain hosts the headquarters of the U.S. 5th Fleet, the naval force that dominates the Persian Gulf. Kuwait has U.S. troop presence too.
None of these countries wanted to be in this conflict.
None of them. The Gulf states are small countries with big economies and relatively small armies. Their security model is host American forces, maintain diplomatic hedges, build wealth. War is the worst possible scenario for them.
Who else?
Lebanon, through Hezbollah, is involved. Israel has been striking Lebanese territory. Yemen, through the Houthis, is still active. Iraq's Shia militias are stirring. Azerbaijan just got hit by Iranian drones for the first time, likely an accident or a warning shot. France has bases in the UAE and deployed Rafale jets to protect them. Australia has its Middle East headquarters at Al Minhad base in Dubai, which was also targeted.
So you've got Australian military assets being attacked by Iranian drones in Dubai?
Yes. Countries that had no intention of being part of this conflict are suddenly in it because of where they happen to station troops.
Let's take stock. What is the state of play right now, as of early March 2026?
The US and Israel are still bombing Iran. Thousands of targets have been hit. The US Senate tried to pass a war powers bill to halt the attacks, Republicans voted it down. Iran's military infrastructure has taken enormous damage, but Iran is still firing. The Gulf states are managing air defense situations daily. Travel is in chaos, dozens of airlines have suspended Middle East routes. Dubai Airport is struggling to recover.
And what about inside Iran? What's happening politically?
This is the huge unknown. Khamenei is dead. Iran now has to appoint a new supreme leader, a process that's supposed to go through a body called the Assembly of Experts, but that entire process is happening under bombardment, with the regime under maximum stress. There have been protests inside Iran. The 2025 and 2026 Iranian protest movements were already significant before this war started. There are Iranians who hate the regime and see this as an opportunity. There are Iranians who are nationalist and rallying around the flag even if they hate the clerics. It's enormously complicated.
Could this lead to regime change?
That's what the US appears to be aiming for, or at least, that's what analysts are inferring from the scale and target selection of Operation Epic Fury. Hitting regime leadership, not just military hardware, suggests the goal is regime decapitation. Whether that's achievable is a different question. Iran is a country of 90 million people with a deep state apparatus that doesn't simply collapse because the figurehead is dead.
History is not encouraging on the regime change front.
It's really not. Iraq 2003 is the obvious cautionary tale. Removing Saddam Hussein created a vacuum that Iran actually filled. The rise of Iranian influence in Iraq after 2003 was one of the great geopolitical ironies of that era. If the Islamic Republic collapses or fragments, who fills the vacuum? That's a question nobody seems to have a confident answer to.
What about the nuclear question? If the regime falls, what happens to any nuclear material Iran has accumulated?
One of the most alarming sub-questions in this whole situation. Iran's nuclear program has been significantly degraded. The June 2025 strikes and Operation Epic Fury have hit multiple facilities. But Iran is a large country with a sophisticated program. The risk of loose nuclear material in a chaotic post-regime environment is something military planners are acutely aware of.
Let's step back for a second and ask, could this have been avoided? Was there an off-ramp?
That's the heartbreaking question, isn't it? There were nuclear negotiations throughout 2025. The Biden-era JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear deal that limited Iran's enrichment in exchange for sanctions relief, had already collapsed under Trump's first-term withdrawal in 2018. Iran spent years advancing its nuclear capabilities precisely because it no longer had the deal as a constraint. By 2025, Iran was months, possibly weeks, away from enough weapons-grade uranium for a bomb.
And Israel's position has always been, an Iranian nuclear bomb is an existential threat.
Israel has said for 20 years that it would not allow Iran to get nuclear weapons. With a country like Iran, whose leadership has called for Israel's elimination, that position isn't irrational. But the method, and the timing, and the decision to bring the US fully into direct warfare with Iran, those choices have consequences for the entire region.
For Toby, and for anyone listening who's trying to make sense of this, here's the big picture as I understand it. This isn't really about Dubai. Dubai is collateral in a conflict that's fundamentally about America, Israel, and Iran's 45-year Cold War finally going hot.
That's exactly right. Dubai was targeted not because Iran has some long-standing grievance with Dubai specifically, although the island's dispute and the Abraham Accords are real friction points, but because Dubai hosts American power. And in a war between Iran and the US-Israel alliance, any country that hosts American power is a legitimate target in Iran's military logic.
The Gulf states made a strategic choice over decades. Align with America, host its military, accept its security umbrella in exchange for protection and economic partnership. That choice has served them incredibly well. They built the most extraordinary economic success stories in the region.
And now they're being asked to pay a price for that choice, a price they didn't agree to, for a war they didn't start.
What happens next? Where does this go?
Honestly, the uncertainty is enormous. A few possible trajectories. The most optimistic, Iran's regime is so destabilized by the loss of Khamenei and the military damage that it agrees to a ceasefire and some kind of political transition. The most pessimistic, this becomes a long-burning regional war, Iranian proxies activate fully in Lebanon and Iraq, and the broader Middle East slides into a protracted conflict that devastates the global economy through oil supply disruption and trade chaos.
The Strait of Hormuz.
One of the great choke points of global trade. If Iran decides to mine it or block it, we're talking about oil price spikes that would make 2022 look mild. The world gets about 20% of its oil supply through that narrow strip of water. And sitting at the entrance to it are those three disputed islands that Iran has held since 1971.
Everything connects.
That's the thing about the Middle East, everything connects. The island's dispute connects to the strait, connects to oil, connects to global economy, connects to US military presence, connects to Israel, connects back to the Islamic Revolution of 1979. You pull one thread and the whole tapestry moves.
Ryan, if you had to leave our listeners with one thing to understand about this conflict, what would it be?
I'd say this: what you're watching is the culmination of 45 years of a Cold War turning hot. Iran and the US-Israel alliance have been fighting through proxies, through sanctions, through cyber operations, through covert assassinations, since 1979. Everything that's happened, Hamas and Hezbollah and Houthis and nuclear negotiations and Abraham Accords and Soleimani's assassination and October 7th, all of it has been building toward some kind of direct confrontation. And here we are.
And the Gulf states, Dubai, Bahrain, Riyadh, Doha, they are the battlefield for a war that two of the parties decided to fight.
Without asking anyone else's permission. And that's what makes this moment so raw for the people who live there. Millions of people went to sleep on February 27th in what they thought was one of the safest, most stable places on Earth. And they woke up to missile alerts.
It's a genuinely frightening situation. We'll keep covering this as it develops. For now, I'm Emma.
And I'm Ryan. Thanks for listening to Claude Talks. This is a breaking and developing story. We'll have another episode as things evolve. Stay safe, everyone.
See you next time.